Hello. Welcome to the show called The Environment. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with SunSounds of Arizona. I'm going to be reading articles from the National Wildlife Federation magazine called Wildlife. This is the fall 2025 edition. This first article is entitled Sage Wisdom. The subtitle is Scientists Say It's Time to Flip the Script to Prioritize Saving What's Left of the Sagebrush Biome. This was written by Brianna Randall. From atop a rise in southwest Montana, silver-colored sagebrush rolls away in every direction. Pronghorn and elk graze on bunch grasses, while yarrow and paintbrush peek above the bushes. Cold, clear creeks wind through the steppe, forming the headwaters of the mighty Missouri and Yellowstone rivers. Simon Buzzard, a wildlife connectivity manager for the National Wildlife Federation's Northern Rockies, Prairies, and Pacific regions, Simon said, quote, "Southwest Montana is core sagebrush, the best of the best. It provides key habitat for migratory big game species, as well as large carnivores like grizzly bears and gray wolves." America's wide-open sagebrush range stretches across 13 states and 382,000 square miles. It is the largest contiguous open space in the lower 48 and one of the most intact ecosystems on Earth, on par with the Amazon or the Serengeti. The sagebrush biome provides habitat for more than 350 plant and animal species, including those at-risk wildlife like the pygmy rabbits or the dunes sagebrush lizards and the sage grouse. Sagebrush rangelands also support abundant recreational opportunities like biking, hiking, birding, and hunting, along with rural communities, an indigenous nation, and agricultural landowners who graze livestock. Despite years of measures to protect this habitat, however, the sagebrush biome is disappearing fast. Quote, "We're losing 760,000 acres of core sagebrush each year," unquote, says Tina Mazalewski, who is technical program manager at the nonprofit Spatial Informatics Group Natural Assets Laboratory. Tina went on and said, quote, "It's a wake-up call that we need to change what we're doing," unquote. In 2024, Tina and 70 other experts sounded that call, publishing a suite of sagebrush-related research in a special issue of Rangeland Ecology and Management. Their research shows that to conserve what's left of the sagebrush ecosystem, quote, "business as usual is not going to cut it," unquote, she said. 2 years earlier, local, state, and federal partners had developed a framework, the Sagebrush Conservation Design, to better target resources invested in the biome's conservation. Based on satellite imagery that tracks vegetation over the past 7 decades, the design delineated core and degraded sagebrush zones. Core areas have the highest amount of native shrubs and perennial plants, and the least amount of invasive weeds or encroaching trees. Joe Smith, a rangeland ecologist at the University of Montana, and who is a member of the Natural Resource Conservation Service's Working Lands for Wildlife team, which is one that helped develop that framework, Joe said, quote, "These are the places that have changed the least over time," unquote. Yet, Tina's research reveals that between 2000 and 2020, only about 20% of all sagebrush conservation funding went to protect these intact core areas, while 80% was spent on restoring the degraded areas. She says that if we flipped the funding script and funneled 80% into protecting core areas, we would be 5 times more effective at conserving the sagebrush biome. Nicknamed, quote, "defend the core," unquote, this new approach is starting to catch on around the West. Defending the core does not mean writing off degraded areas, she notes, but changing why and how to invest in those places, building wildfire fuel breaks to protect communities, or prioritizing key wildlife migration corridors, for example. Simon Buzzard agrees and says, quote, to conserve remaining big game migrations, we are going to have to put some effort into degraded areas, unquote. But overall, he favors the focus on core habitat. And he went on and said, quote, the primary reason that initial attempts to conserve and rebound declining sage grouse were ineffective is because they were too species specific and did not take into account the full scope of habitat health. NWF and our partners prioritize working in important, intact landscapes. Like Buzzard, others agree with the big picture strategy, but they see the need for a nuanced approach at the local level. For more than 20,000 years, indigenous peoples from dozens of groups have inhabited the sagebrush biome. Jason Baldus, a member of the Eastern Shoshone tribe in present-day Wyoming, and who is director of the NWF's Tribal Bison Program, Jason said, for us, the sagebrush ecosystem is a source of medicine and food that we still utilize ceremonially. Bison, a keystone species of the sagebrush biome, once numbered 30 to 60 million. But due to the disposition of indigenous groups and the federal government-sponsored slaughter of bison in the 19th century, bison are now considered ecologically extinct. Bringing bison back will require, quote, out-of-the-box, landscape-wide conservation approaches, unquote, Baldus said. Jason believes that working across jurisdictional boundaries to defend core habitat, quote, is certainly a more well-aligned approach to conservation, one that translates to restoring both bison and sagebrush ecosystems. But I think we need to have a mosaic of conservation priorities, and some degraded areas may be important to bison that are not part of a larger core system. Scientists say that nearly 90% of core sagebrush loss stems from two threats: invasive annual grasses like cheatgrass, ventanada, and medusa head, and encroaching native conifers like pinyon pine and western juniper that are expanding their ranges as a result of fire suppression. Both kinds of intruding vegetation end up replacing native perennial plants, and that impacts water and nutrient cycling and degrading the habitat for sagebrush wildlife. Invasive annual grasses are especially worrisome because they gobble up sagebrush habitat quickly. They also fuel more frequent fires across the rangelands where sagebrush grows. Cheatgrass is a species native to Eurasia that was introduced in the 1800s, and it spreads quickly via seed. It dries out much faster than native plants, sending sagebrush habitat up in flames every few years instead of every several decades, which was the historic fire cycle in sagebrush country. As more conifers infiltrate the range, those fires rage hotter, leaving more bare ground for invasive grasses to colonize post-fire. Buzzard said this vicious cycle can transform and degrade habitat to the point where it's hard to get it back. According to research conducted by Michelle Christ, Wildland Fire Science Program Coordinator for the U.S. Geological Survey, some 2.1 million acres of sagebrush rangelands burn in an average year. Now, the good news is that native perennial plants and shrubs are more resistant to wildfires. Less than 2% of Christ's estimated annual fires occur in core sagebrush areas. Because core areas tend to be farther from human development, they are less prone to human-caused ignitions, which accounts for 90% of all fire starts. Invasive grasses are an extremely challenging threat to tackle, in part because they are fast-moving and widespread. Using a free remote sensing app called the Rangeland Analysis Platform, Smith has documented an 8-fold increase in cheatgrass since 1990 across the Great Basin. Now that's a wide swath of land, which includes portions of Oregon, Nevada, Idaho, Utah, and California. He said, quote, "You can see the cover of invasive grasses double from one year to the next, and there's no silver bullet to combat them yet. We could see the iconic sagebrush ecosystem transformed into a highly flammable landscape within one lifetime," unquote. Well, fortunately, new mapping technology, like that Rangeland Analysis Platform, is helping pinpoint where to target cheatgrass treatments. Once scientists determine the extent of the problem, like a single pasture or an entire watershed, the next step is to inventory how bad it is. Are any native plants left? If not, will bare ground need to be replanted once the invasives are gone? Land managers can then decide if and where to spray an herbicide. New pre-emergent herbicides such as Rejuvra are showing promise for halting cheatgrass in its tracks. Like other herbicides, these chemicals could inadvertently harm native plants or animals or accumulate in waterways. Yet because they kill seeds of invasive grasses in the soil's upper layers, they allow deep-rooted native perennials to come back in the spring. In Wyoming, Sublette County provides hope for winning the battle against cheatgrass. Using pre-emergent herbicides on more than 97,000 acres since 2015, a team of public and private partners has treated nearly every known cheatgrass infestation in the county. And so far, the invasives have not come back. The county's success is inspiring more people to defend their own sagebrush rangelands. Over the past 2 years, the University of Wyoming's Institute for Managing Annual Grasses Invading Natural Ecosystems, all of those words, spell out the letters, imagine. Well, that group has hosted virtual and in-person workshops across the West, teaching 850 people how to use mapping tools and herbicides and targeted livestock grazing and other strategies to keep invasives at bay. Claire Visconti, an Imagine Outreach coordinator and an assistant research scientist, says the workshops take people from defending the core to defending your core. Defending sagebrush cores also means keeping them tree-free. The approach to eliminate encroaching conifers can be more clear-cut than eradicating cheatgrass. You just lop them down as they spread into the sagebrush habitat, preferably as small saplings before they mature and produce thousands of seeds. The trick is to manage for tree-free sagebrush landscapes at large scales. An impressive example is in southern Idaho, where public land managers and private landowners have been removing encroaching junipers from more than 400 square miles of sagebrush habitats since 2004. Smith and his colleagues studied 288 treated sites and found that perennial plants and shrubs recovered following the tree removal. Such projects have boosted populations of sagebrush-loving birds. Elise Zuri, an ecologist with the University of Montana's Working Lands for Wildlife research team, said, quote, "It's pretty clear that sagebrush birds are more abundant and have better reproductive success in areas with less trees," unquote. From 2019 to 2022, Zaria tracked the nesting success of 8 songbird species in a valley in southwest Montana, a region where tree cover had doubled since 1990. She surveyed sites where the Bureau of Land Management had removed Douglas fir trees to restore sagebrush habitat, as well as other sites where no trees had been cut. Fledgling production of the Brewer's Sparrow, That's a 5-inch long bird known for its extended buzzy songs and a species of conservation concern in several western states. Well, it was 119% higher in the locations without trees. The birds avoided nesting within 98 feet of a tree, Zari said. Quote, they were cramming their territories into tree-free areas. It made me wonder how much habitat we have lost for brewer sparrows and what might happen in the future if trees continue to fill in, unquote. Well, to find out, she overlaid the territories of 1,161 brewer's sparrows with historical aerial imagery and ran simulations to model past and future abundance of the birds in the valley. Now, this part of Montana already has lost 1/4 of its brewer's sparrows population during the past 70 years, and Zari's simulations show that their numbers will decline an additional 60% in the next 30 years if no action is taken to remove the encroaching trees. She said if trees are actively managed in the future, an estimated 460 brewer sparrow fledglings will flit around the valley each year, but the number of offspring craters to just 200 fledglings if there are no trees removed. Zari said, quote, if we defend the core, we can stem the loss and hold the line for the animals and people that rely on those habitats, unquote. Well known for the male's elaborate courtship dances at communal display grounds during the mating season, the greater sage grouse is a signature species of sagebrush ecosystems. Greater sage grouse also, quote, are a very important cultural and iconic species to many Native American tribes, unquote, Baldus says. Dependent on sagebrush plants for food, cover, and roosting, the plump, chicken-sized birds have declined by 80% since 1965, largely due to habitat loss, fragmentation, and degradation. Baldus said, quote, we need to consider how development and encroachment are impacting that bird and its habitat and overall diversity, unquote. Because trees can shelter predators, sage grouse, just like brewer sparrows, avoid nesting in landscapes with more than a few trees per acre. Now, in southern Oregon, where partners removed junipers from 54 square miles of public and private lands, the birds' numbers were 12% higher than in neighboring landscapes where trees remained, according to a 2021 study that was published in Ecosphere. Zari said, quote, these birds evolved with cover that's fairly flat and low to the ground, so they are not accustomed to tall structures and defending against the predators that come with them, like raptors and weasels or chipmunks, unquote. According to two studies published in the REM special issue, protecting core sagebrush is synonymous with saving sage grouse. One study found that while populations of sage grouse remained stable in core areas biome-wide between 1996 and 2021, they dropped by a staggering 64% in the degraded rangelands. And on the California-Nevada border, a distinct population of sage grouse has increased by an estimated 37% since 2012. And that was in areas where targeted conservation efforts kept core sagebrush intact compared to places where no conservation took place. Peter Coates, a USGS wildlife biologist and a co-author of both studies, said, quote, by protecting these core areas, we are protecting essentially all life stages of sage grouse, unquote. The best way to maintain these core areas and the wildlife that thrive in them is by working across ownership boundaries and at large scales, as evidenced by success stories in Wyoming and Idaho and Montana. Buzzard said, quote, the recipe for success is collaborative, on-the-ground conservation programs and local partnerships. And then he added, that this ensures that private landowners and agencies are all speaking the same language in terms of priorities on the landscape and how to tackle them, unquote. And that was Brianna Randall's article entitled Sage Wisdom. Well, I don't think we have time for another long article, so I'm going to go to the front of the magazine. There's a section titled Scope, written by Laura Tangley, and there are some shorter articles here. The first one is Monarchs Delay Fall Migration. As the global climate heats up, some species are shifting the timing of seasonal events to keep pace, with animals breeding or migrating sooner, and plants leafing out or flowering earlier. Because species do not shift in tandem, potential mismatches between interdependent species are concerned. To find out if such phenological shifts are occurring among monarch butterflies or their milkweed host plants at Iowa's Camp Dodge military installation, biologists analyzed observations of monarch arrival and departure dates collected between 2003 and 2019. They also reviewed long-term data on the bloom time of the region's common milkweed plants. So in the Journal of Animal Ecology, they report that while the timing of milkweed flowering and monarch arrival in spring had not changed, keeping the species in sync, milkweeds were blooming later and monarchs were staying longer at the end of the season, delaying their fall migration to Mexico by an average of 9 days. The study's lead author, Montana State University ecologist Diane Dubinsky, says this longer breeding season could have benefits, and it could also have cost to declining monarchs. The cost might include exposure to late-season predators and parasites, or monarch eggs laid too late to complete development. Our next short article is entitled Rafting Iguanas. 4 iguana species endemic to the Fiji Islands have long been an enigma, the only native iguanas outside the Americas. How did the reptiles get to this remote South Pacific archipelago? One popular theory held that Fiji iguanas are descendants of an extinct iguanid lineage once widespread in the Pacific. But a new genetic analysis by biologists at the University of California at Berkeley and University of San Francisco shows that the reptiles are closely related to North America's desert iguanas. Publishing their findings in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the scientists say the two lineages likely separated 34 million years ago. Their results also suggest that ancestors of Fiji iguanas rafted 5,000 miles across the Pacific from western North America, the longest presumed transoceanic dispersal of any land animal. Lead author and USF herpetologist Simon Scarpetta said, quote, "Iguanas, and desert iguanas in particular, are resistant to starvation and dehydration. If any group of vertebrate could make a 5,000-mile journey across the Pacific on a mass of vegetation, this would be the one," unquote. And our third one is How Bats Conquer a Cocktail Party Nightmare. In many bat species, such as Mexican free-tailed bats, thousands to hundreds of thousands of individuals emerge from their daytime roost simultaneously each night, creating what scientists have dubbed a cocktail party nightmare of clashing echolocation calls. To shed light on how the animals deal with this sensory challenge, scientists from Tel Aviv University and the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior attached tiny trackers and microphones to the greater mouse-tailed bats emerging from a cave in Israel. Computer modeling of their data, reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, reveals that an emerging bat quickly increases its distance from the center of the group and adjusts echolocation calls to be more sensitive to nearby objects. Co-author Omer Mazar of Tel Aviv University said, quote, "Imagine you're a bat flying through a cluttered space. The most important object you need to know about is the bat directly in front of you." And that was How Bats Conquer a Cocktail Party Nightmare. Then we had Rafting Iguanas. And our first short article was Monarchs Delay Fall Migration. And those are all in the section of the magazine known as Scope, written by Laura Tangley. Next up, we have The Great Divide. It's actually written by Delaney McPherson, but it's about a photo by Rob Green. Working as a backcountry guide in Guatemala, photographer Rob Green saw many human impacts on the environment firsthand, and that experience led him to pursue a master's degree in natural resource conflict resolution at the University of Montana. When the COVID-19 pandemic limited travel, he focused his lens on interactions close to home. He said, "So many issues are universal. Habitat fragmentation, biodiversity loss, these things are everywhere." So, between July to November of 2023, he set up a camera trap near U.S. Highway 89 in Livingston, Montana, which leads into Yellowstone National Park. That's where wildlife and vehicle collisions are common. He got this picture of an elk calf on the very last day before he removed the camera. He said, quote, "The young calf looks confused. It's a sadly accurate metaphor. In these places their ancestors have known for millennia, the landscape is changing faster than they are able to naturally adapt," unquote. The group, Yellowstone Safe Passage, estimates there are more than 160 wildlife vehicle collisions annually on that 54-mile stretch of Highway 89 between the towns of Livingston and Gardner. Based on the time of the day and where the trap was installed, Green suspects the elk were on their way to cross the highway, although their fate is unknown. And that was the little article, Great Divide. It was all about a photo. Well, we're out of time. I'm going to have to say goodbye. I'm Gene, a volunteer with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to articles from the National Wildlife Federation magazine, the Fall 2025 edition. Have a great day.